Well, good afternoon, Juno. It's Pat Moore, your host for today's edition of Juno Afternoon. It's just almost 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News. Today on the show, we'll hear from Kevin Sweeney, who is the Pillars of America speaker tomorrow at noon. Sarah Lewis will be here to update us on the slow food. Elise Tomlinson will be in to tell us about her art show, which opens Friday at the Jack. We'll hear from Jessica Paris about Bead for Life and the Rose Urban Rural Exchange Program folks, Jenna Monroe, and from Floyd Dryden will be here with some of the students that are participating. Weather forecast, rain showers, highs around 49, southeast winds 10 miles per hour, and tonight rain showers, lows to around 38, southeast winds 10 to 15 miles per hour.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A decades-old dispute over water rights on Montana's largest reservation has come to a close with the signing of the Crow Water Compact. Montana Public Radio's Dan Boyce reports.
Three men at a wooden table in Washington, D.C., passing around three copies of the Crow Water Compact for them each to sign. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar, Montana Governor Brian Schweitzer, and sitting in the middle in a traditional headdress, Crow Chairman Cedric Black Eagle.
Water gives life among our people. This compact ensures that Crow people will have water and the necessary infrastructure for generations to come.
The Crow tribe has been in litigation with the federal government for over 30 years, claiming the tribe wasn't being given adequate water resources. Interior Secretary Salazar says the ceremony begins implementing the Crow Water Rights Settlement Act, signed by President Obama at the end of 2010.
It does show how when we work together we can make very significant progress and fulfilling broken promises.
The tribe gains new water rights from the compact, and Salazar says the Bureau of Reclamation will spend the over $460 million to design and build a comprehensive water system for the tribe.
The existing drinking water system has had such significant deficiencies in terms of both capacity and water quality that many tribal members at times must haul water.
The new system will overhaul drinking water infrastructure and upgrade the tribe's dilapidated irrigation project. Salazar says its construction will also provide much-needed jobs for the Crow. Governor Brian Schweitzer.
Today is a good day for the American people. It's a good day for the Crow people. It's a good day for Montana.
By signing the compact, the Crow tribe waives any legal claims against the federal government for being denied water resources in the past. For National Native News, I'm Dan Boyce in Helena, Montana.
Food security was the top issue raised by Alaska Native leaders with a United Nations official. He was in Anchorage over the weekend. Johanna Urich has more.
Jimmy Stotts, president of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference Alaska, says the conflict between Alaska Natives and state and federal governments over hunting and fishing has to stop.
It's got to the point that people are being criminalized for doing what they've done forever, getting food for their families.
Jane Zanaya, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, plans to release his report later this summer. This is the first time a UN official has made a formal assessment of human rights in the United States.
Hopefully the scrutiny that is brought to bear through this process will have some impact.
Anaya will present his report on the U.S. to the UN Human Rights Commission in September. For National Native News, I'm Johanna Urich.
Beer companies are asking a judge to dismiss a lawsuit by a South Dakota tribe that accuses the companies of knowingly contributing to alcohol-related problems on its reservation. According to the Associated Press, motions were filed Friday. The Oglala Sioux tribe filed the lawsuit earlier this year against four stores in White Clay, Nebraska. The tribe alleges the stores in the border town sold to its members knowing they would take alcohol back to the dry reservation and is seeking damages for health care and law enforcement costs. During this month in 2007, Virginia tribal leaders met Queen Elizabeth during the commemoration of Jamestown's 400th anniversary. The Queen mentioned Native Americans during her address at the state capitol, but she didn't apologize for the impacts the English settlement had on Native people. Many Native people felt that it would have been an opportunity for her to issue an apology. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
Support for National Native News comes from the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller, and Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. With funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
6 minutes after three, oh well, 5 minutes and 30 seconds anyway, and you're in tune with KTOO News. Check that weather one more time. Looks like rain showers are going to be with us today, tonight, and Wednesday. And then Wednesday night, it backs off to cloudy with scattered rain showers. And then Thursday, we're looking at it being mostly cloudy with only a chance of rain. And Thursday night's forecast is for mostly cloudy. Friday and Friday night, looks like the rain may sneak back in there with a chance of rain. Highs all week up in the 50s during the day, and lows down around 37, 38. So nothing freezing or anything like that. And looks like a Juneau day with a really nice looking possibility for Thursday and Friday, possibly. My guest is Kevin Sweeney, and he's going to be the speaker in this week's presentation of the Pillars of America series. Welcome, Kevin Sweeney.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. I'm honored to be here.
Yeah. How are you liking Juneau's weather?
It's okay.
We caught some rain just in time for your visit.
It's okay.
So you'll be talking tomorrow afternoon, tomorrow morning, actually. The doors for your talk open at 11:15 over at Centennial Hall, and then they'll be serving lunch at 11:30, and you'll address the crowd at 11:30 or so, 12 o'clock, something like that. What are you going to talk about?
Well, we're going to talk how to excel under pressure.
Okay.
How to have that passion for what you do every day, how to really focus on the right thing, how to be the teammate that all your colleagues, all your customers, all your friends covet, and how to really have that confidence that you can excel when the heat's on.
Okay. You've written a couple of books about that topic, haven't you?
Yes, I've written two books. One, Pressure Cooker Confidence, How to Lead When the Heat is On. And then the second book is Conversations with the Colonel, Lessons in Life, Leadership, and Wisdom.
You're a colonel retired from the United States Air Force. Okay, and this lieutenant colonel that's sitting opposite me once brought a KC-135, which is about the size of it's a military version of the 707.
Yes.
You once brought one of those back to the field with two engines falling off of a wing, right?
Yes.
How did you keep it upright?
Well, very carefully.
Well, that's the correct answer.
That's a very interesting question. Thank goodness my co-pilot was as big as I was, because it took us an hour and 15 minutes to get back from when the incident happened. And I had to fly for 5 minutes, and then Jay had to fly for 5 minutes. We had to physically overpower the airplane to get her home. So that's our job. That's what we're paid to do.
So one wing, there's two engines on each wing, right?
Yes, correct.
So two of them fell off.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. That's startling. So then I guess the plane dips to the other side real bad, and you've got to correct it by putting in a lot of flap and a lot of aileron.
A lot of aileron and rudder, and just physically had to overpower it, and we lost our hydraulics, so it was really down to manual control. And
wow,
and just
it's like
physical.
Losing power steering on a car.
Wow.
Wow. An hour, what altitude were you at when the engines came off the thing?
Well, we were at start at 25,000 feet, and we lost about 11,000 feet getting them back under control when they came off. And then we climbed back up to about 15 to fly it back.
Huh. Wow. Holding hard to the left or right.
Well, actually, flies opposite what you think. If I had my left engine's gone, I had my right engine's there, you'd think it would want to turn me to the left.
Yeah.
Actually, it rolls to the right because the engines are gone. All the gas in that wing siphoned out. There's no drag on the wing, so it actually wants to roll the opposite way, which is one of the first days of pilot training. They teach you fly the airplane.
Yeah.
And so if you just did it very mechanically, well, I don't think we would have made it yet, because we'd have stepped on the wrong rudder and got us upside down. And and being upside down in the 707 is not my favorite thing to do.
Well, I can understand that. This is a big airplane. Mm-hmm. So the question, I guess, that comes to what you're going to be talking about tomorrow is how do you – I mean, you can panic,
mm-hmm.
okay, or you can get control of it. So what was it, do you think, in you that – was that made it the better choice of those two?
Well, as a pilot, the United States Air Force does a tremendous job of training you that something's going to happen someday. We take the flight crew occupation, one of the few occupations that persistently and consistently practices for the day when everything's going to go wrong, the day you're in the bucket. The day to expect something unexpected happen. Like, I never expected my engines to come off. But they train that, and we take emergency procedure simulators so that in my mind, I know that someday that day might arrive. And then once it does, it's not unexpected, and I know my job. I know my airplane like the back of my hand. I've properly prepared, and you just, that little voice in the back of your mind just says to you, hey, today's the day, and you just respond.
How did the rest of the crew react when this happened? You've got how many people on board?
It's a four-person crew.
Okay, four-person crew.
A pilot, co-pilot, and navigator.
Yeah.
And those are officers. And then the fourth member is the non-officer, is a sergeant. Well, that's always very...
He's the boom operator.
The boom operator.
Right?
He's the one that goes back.
Yeah,
Yes. He's the one that goes back in the back of the airplane and refuels those fighters at 500 miles an hour.
Right.
Well, that's always a very interesting question because one of my crew members actually said to me, are we going to have to bail out? And that question, when he asked that, the other two crew members didn't ask that question, but I knew they were very intently listening to what my answer would be. And I didn't have time to go, I had to give them a very succinct, crisp answer. And I said, Greg, I said, no, stick with me, we'll be fine. And to have been able, and he said, yes, sir. And I need 110% of all their efforts to get us back safe, because it was a team effort getting an airplane that's badly wounded back in one piece. So I had to have them. But that was really something that really taught me about leadership. Leadership is not based upon your rank or position. Leadership is a gift that your people give you. And based on the things I'd done before that flight with them.
Say that again.
Leadership is a gift that your people had given you.
So it really comes from the people you're leading.
Yes.
It's not from you.
It's not from me. It's from them.
Yeah.
It's a gift that they give you. And I really learned that night that based on some things I'd done earlier, that crew had given me the gift of leadership. So when I said, no, stick with me, we'll be fine, they knew that I was one to be trusted. They trusted me. And I had to have them.
With their lives.
Yes, because that's actually what he was asking me. Are we going to die tonight?
Yeah.
And I told him, no, we're not. We didn't say those words, but that is the essence of the communication.
And you're communicating with everybody on the airplane.
Everybody.
When that answer
those
comes.
Other two guys are listening very intently on what is he going to say.
Okay, so let's translate this out of the night sky over Kuwait in what, 80?
91.
91, okay. Let's translate this. We don't have to fly airplanes without engines. That's not what I do for a living.
No.
But how do I deal with that? What can I learn from that?
Well, one of the things is you properly prepare. You know, it's what you do. A lot of times people say want to blame somebody else if I don't do it right. Well, I learned early in life, and my father taught me that when you properly prepare enough to be good enough, you'll make it. So when you don't get what you want, if you don't get the grade you want, if you don't get that sale, why do you ever ask yourself, whose fault was it? As a pilot, my job was to get us back. And I was trained that there's a myriad of things not real good that are going to happen to you. But you are responsible for handling that and being able to get back. I'm going to have a test question that's not my favorite test question. I'm still responsible for answering that. I'm going to have a customer that the heavy competition's calling on that I really wish they weren't there. But I'm still responsible. I'm going to have a project that gets behind the timeline over the budget. But I'm still responsible. And you have to have that personal integrity and that proper preparation up front. And focus on what you should focus on. Ignore the immaterial. Focus on what you should be, that great teammate that everybody covets, and have that charismatic confidence that you can get the job done.
Great teammate. says that the leader is part of the team.
Yes.
And not somehow like
yes.
up above it.
Yes.
And I think that's what you're saying when you talk about that gift of leadership.
Oh, General Charles Horner was the commander of all Allied Air Forces during the Gulf War. And everybody knows about General Schwarzkopf, who was the Supreme Commander. But General Horner was the commander of all Allied Air Forces. And General Horner, I was stationed in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. The night before we got to come home after the war was over, the Saudis were throwing a big banquet for all the American air crews there as a thank you. And General Horner flew down from Riyadh down to Jeddah to go to that dinner. I'm at the dinner, and General Caruana, who is the general over all the tanker forces in Desert Storm, he came to me and said, Major, I was still major at the time, I hadn't made colonel yet, and he said, Major, would you like to meet General Horner? And I said, sure. So I went and got my crew and said, let's go meet him. So General Caruana takes us over to meet General Horner. And he says, General Caruana says, General, I'd like you to meet the crew that brought that tanker back with the two engines missing. And General Horner looks at me and goes, man, you don't know how happy I was. I was happier than you were the night you made it back alive. And I'm like, holy Moses. I came to find out that General Horner would put out his war plan, and then he would sit in the command post and watch and see if anybody called a mayday or was in trouble and see if followed them to see if they got home. And I said, well, thank you, General. Well, about 10, 12 years later, I'm speaking at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, and General Horner's on the same program I am. Well, the night before the program, we were all there, and there was a reception. Well, General Horner's at the reception. Well, I walked up. I'd retired by then, and General Horner had made his fourth star by then, and General Horner was retired by then. But I walked up to him, and I said, General Horner, I'm Kevin Sweeney. I served under you in Desert Storm. Matter of fact, I was that pilot that brought back that tanker that had the two engines. General Horner grabs my hand, slaps me on the back, and says, man, I don't know how you did that, but that was the best I've ever seen.
This
is years later. But yeah. What that taught me, it wasn't about General Horner. It was always about me. I would do anything for General Horner.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear it. So the other thing that's interesting about you that I know the particularly the young members of the audience tomorrow are going to relate to is you put yourself on a college basketball team kind of out of nowhere, didn't you? What was that about?
Well, when I was a little boy, my dream was to be a college athlete. I thought walking across campus, that leather sweater on all the girls that loved me, I thought it'd be a big deal. My father played college football. I wanted to play. Entering high school, I was 5'1" and 85 pounds. I couldn't make a team.
Yeah.
Finally, I started to grow. Well, right now I'm 6'3" and 230. I graduated from high school, and I went to the University of Missouri my freshman year. I walked on the University of Missouri and made their freshman basketball team. Beat the University of Kansas at Kansas, which is great. Sophomore year, I get cut.
Yeah.
Well, I still thought I was good enough. I called the previous year's assistant coach from Mizzou, University of Missouri. He gives me a scholarship over the phone, and I transferred out to his school, and I was all-conference, all-district, capped the team for him. Beat the number one ranked team in the country, the Razorbacks from University of Arkansas, scheduled us a warm-up patsy. We beat them. And I tell you that story in part of my speech not to tell you and brag about my basketball career, although it is true, the older I get, the better I was.
Yeah.
You know, I look at me, you know. But I tell you that story because for the young folks, everything we do in life sets us up for something in the future, for the day when the final exam is going to be there, because you never stop learning, and you never know when your final exam will really be.
Yeah, when two engines are going to fall off your wing in the middle of the night.
And it might be something unexpected.
Hey, we all got to come hear this guy. 11:30 is the start. The doors open at 11:15. The lunch is served at 11:30. The hangars serving the lunch. It's over in Centennial Hall. There's still tickets available at both Hearthside bookstores. There will be tickets available at the door tomorrow. And Colonel Kevin Sweeney is going to be the speaker in the Pillars of America series. We welcome you to Juneau, and we're looking forward to hearing your speech.
Oh, I'm excited to be here, and I'm honored to be in the Pillars of America Speakers Series.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. At this time of year, a very young male Buick's wren is beginning to learn how to sing. Like a human baby, he'll babble while he experiments with sounds and learns how to organize phrases. The young Buick's wren is listening to the song of his father, who sings a crisp, well-defined song, separated by pauses. Now, let's compare. Here's the song of our young Buick's wren. It's fuzzy, unfocused, a little rambling. Here's the adult male again. It's fully developed and unique to that male. Each adult male Buick's wren has his own set of songs. A young wren grows up learning his father's songs, but when it matures and moves to its own new territory, it will leave behind the song of its father to create a song that sounds more like its new neighbor's. BirdNote would like to thank avian communication expert Donald Kruzma for his research on the Buick's wren. You'll find a link to his work at birdnote.org.
It's 21 minutes after 3, and you're in tune with KTOO News, listening to Juno Afternoon. Pat Moore, your host. I have two lovely ladies in the studio with me who are going to tell us about a number of upcoming events that have to do with slow foods. Sarah Lewis is here with Megan Gregory. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
So you have a race coming up. It's not often that you get a race with slow food. How's that work, Megan?
Well, it's the second annual Every Mile is Worth It race that Search sponsors. And the race is to raise awareness about suicide prevention in Southeast Alaska. And the reason I invited slow foods is because on top of staying active, I think it's important that we think about the foods that we eat and we get more engaged with growing them in our local communities in Southeast. So I wanted slow foods to have a presence there.
Yeah, it makes good sense.
Yeah.
It's part of the healthy lifestyle, I guess. And Sarah, you have how will Slow Foods participate in the race?
Well, we were actually thrilled to do something with Search and with Megan on this because it isn't exactly what you would normally think of, you know, running fast and then sitting down to eat.
Yeah. But I assumed you were taking cookery with you on the in the run. I see you running along
your
with your walk
while
and
you're
your
running. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it was really good because part of the slow food philosophy is about community, and it's about connecting with all different segments of your community. And when Megan gave us this opportunity, we thought it was a wonderful idea. So mm-hmm. What we're going to do is, as soon as all the runners come in, approximately noon, so if people aren't running and they're just coming to the potluck, around noon at one of the shelters at Sandy Beach, we're going to be setting up the potluck. It's our quarterly potluck for slow food, so we always have classes, well, sort of speakers, presenters on different subjects. And our theme for this one is growing and gathering. And so we're going to have presentation on urban farming, so container gardening, and then pretty key right now, what to do with all those garbage cans that no one's going to have a use for come here pretty soon when Arrow Refuse brings their new ones in.
Mm.
How to compost with garbage cans, things you can do with garbage cans, because we're going to have a lot. So that's going to be something we might talk about there, as well as grassroots community garden organizing. We're going to try to have someone talk about that, and harvesting from the ocean and from the forest. So some of our natural harvest.
Now, I think, Megan, we're going to have you back on before the race actually happens so that people can schedule. But people are signing up for this now or can sign up for this now?
Yeah, I've created...
How would they do that?
Well, it's a Southeast Roadrunners event. So if they just go to southeastroadrunners.com, they can find... I don't think it's been uploaded, but it's in the works. There's an application that they can fill out, or it's a registration form that they can fill out, and they can mail it to me. Or they can just register the day of the race.
Email it off the site like that, or do they print it down?
They'd print it and mail it with a check.
Okay.
Or they can register the day of. It's just $10 for adults, 19 and older, if they want to pre-register, $12 the day of, and for youth, it's pay as you can.
Okay. And the, again, now the idea is that the race then ends up at the Slow Foods quarterly banquet.
Potluck.
Now,
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure everybody knows that you have a quarterly potluck.
Well, we do. Yeah. We have a quarterly potluck. Right. We've actually, that's been started to be a pretty good pattern for us. We've done it for a couple years now.
So you must have just had one in April then.
We had one January, actually, I think.
Oh, okay.
So I can't remember.
Your definition of quarters is different from the rest of
it. It is. Okay. It kind of depends on...
Well, slow quarters.
we wanted to match it with Megan's event, so we kind of postponed it. We held it off a little bit so that we could do that. Yeah,
okay.
So we kind of go with the seasons, and those aren't necessarily quarterly in June. So, yeah.
That all makes sense. Don't pay your taxes that way.
Well, yeah.
Okay. So then these potlucks, anybody can come?
Anybody can come. Okay. Yeah, anybody can come.
Where do you usually hold them? Are they always out?
All different places. Oh,
okay.
Sometimes we have them out in Pavitt's. They've been really gracious to host some of our potlucks. Sandy
Health
Beach, yes,
there,
right,
you know,
right. Cooperative Extension's office, we've had it there. We have it various places depending on what the topics are going to be and what the season is.
Okay.
Yeah.
How would people find out when the quarterly potluck is?
Very good question. Both the quarterly potlucks or any events that are being sponsored by Slow Food, you can find if you go ahead and you can either go to our Facebook page at Slow Food Southeast Alaska. Or if you email slowfood.seak@gmail.com,
okay.
You can get on our mailing list, which is pretty hefty now. We're up in around 300 people get our email on a regular basis. And some of the events that I'm going to be telling you about here, we email those out to everybody on our email list. But our Facebook page is a good place just to go get an update.
So besides the quarterly potluck, you have other things coming up?
We sometimes do. Well, I'm going to go ahead and give you a list of things that, although they aren't necessarily Slow Food sponsored, they're ones that we really want to promote to the community. So, for example, for May, on May 5th, you've probably heard about the Juno Chicken Summit, also called Plucko de Mayo. Olay. Bogok. And so that's actually very exciting. The Cooperative Extension, Darren Snyder over there, has been getting this organized. And so that's on May 5th from 9 to 5 at UAS, the lecture hall in the Egan building. That's a $20 registration fee. You can go to their website, and it's a little bit long, but I'll go ahead and – should I go ahead and –
No, sure.
I'll go ahead and do it. So www.uaf.edu/ces/districts/Juno.
So by way of a quick note here, I'm not sure everybody knows that Cooperative Extension comes out of the Land Grant Institution for Estate,
yes.
And our Land Grant campus is actually the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
Yes.
And it's held at UAS, but Darren and his Cooperative Extension activities
are actually
a component of mm-hmm. UAF.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
But we're, you know, we have a great Cooperative Extension office here at the Bill Ray Center, so, and they love it when people just stop in. Mm-hmm. And see all the information that they have. So they're going to be doing the Juno Chicken Summit this upcoming weekend.
So why do we need a chicken summit in Juno? What is
this
about?
You know, the interest in chickens in Juno is just exploding.
Yeah.
We've recently, some of our zoning regulations changed to allow chickens in many more zoning areas, neighborhoods, where we couldn't before. And people want chickens. They want chickens and fresh eggs, and I don't know if people are going to be eating their chickens or just the eggs, but
yeah.
People are really, really interested. It is actually, I think it's going to be a pretty good event this weekend. Yeah.
Good. So this is May 5th, 9 to 5, and it's that $20 fee includes a lunch, right?
Yes, that's what they say.
Mm-hmm. And then there's an afternoon barbecue that follows this that's a 4-H fundraiser.
And the 4-H fundraiser is going to be the barbecue.
And the tie there is that 4-H is actually a component of the Extension Service.
It is.
So, yeah, okay.
It is, right. Yeah. It's one of their really great programs.
We have a few more minutes here. So what else is coming up on the schedule?
So on May 8th, the Juno Food Co-op public meeting is happening. This is kind of a late-breaking event. It's a community response to the planned closing of A&P at the end of the summer. So Greg Fisk locally has very quickly put together a public meeting where we're going to have Andrew Crow, who's a cooperative expert, an expert on creating cooperatives, from the University of Alaska. He's going to be in town, and he's going to give a presentation at this meeting so that people who are interested in what might be able to happen at the A&P depending on whether a new grocery store gets in there or if not, if there's some different things the community can be involved with.
Yeah.
So then on May 12th, there's the annual Mother's Day plant sale out at Safeway parking lot. Mm-hmm. That's always a great, great event. May 19th is Community Day at UAS and from 11 to 4 on the UAS campus. And I'm talking about that one because Slow Food's going to have a table there. So you can get information about Slow Food. We're going to have activities for kids. And that's always just a fun event. The Cooperative Extension also near the end of May is going to be offering classes. Roxy Dinstall, the agent up from Fairbanks, is going to be coming down. So she's going to have classes to offer, and she can test your pressure canner gauges, which is an important thing. To get more information about that or to let them know what classes you might be interested in, you can contact Dora at the Cooperative Extension, and her number is 796-6221. Then, of course, June 2nd is the search race and the slow food potluck. Just to let people know, repeat, that all of the things that I'm saying here are going to be on our Facebook page.
Right.
And also you can email us and we'll send it out to you as well. So if you didn't get that phone number, we can have it.
Sounds like we have an incredibly active slow foods movement.
We do.
Lots of different
events. Fast growing slow foods movement.
300 people on the mailing list, and maybe we'll grow it a little bit from this broadcast. Megan, thank you so much for telling us about this upcoming race. Sarah, thank you so much for updating us on slow foods activities.
Thank you for having us.
Everyone get in the car. We're going to the KL store. They've got grains and granola bars. But kale's what we go there for. You could buy tofu or kombucha. A bag of goji berries, whatever suits ya. But as for me, I'm going green. I'm going to the kale store. Should eat more kale. It makes you healthier without fail. I tell you with confidence, it's rich in nutrients and antioxidants. Vitamin K and vitamin C, beta-carotene and more. So don't delay, today's the day. We're going to the kale. Is bad, bad, bad. And any produce that you don't eat, why you can throw it on your compost heap. I don't want to preach to you, my friend. Don't want you thinking I'm a bore. But it'd be cool if we carpool. We're going to the kale.
A hilarious thing called the going to the kale store, closing out our little interview with the slow foods folk. It's 27 minutes before 4 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News. My next guest is a local artist and a personal friend. Elise Tomlinson is here to tell us about a show that will open, I guess, May 4th?
Friday.
Yeah,
it's Friday.
So where's it opening?
At the Juno Arts and Humanities Council Gallery, across from Centennial Hall.
And what are we going to see?
I've worked on about 11 new oil paintings that I've pretty much started in the last 3 months. So They range in size from pretty small, 16 by 20, to 36 by 36, rather large paintings from photographs I've taken around the Juneau area and Douglas.
So I was reading the press release about your thing, and it said that you carried a camera around for a year trying to take a good picture every day.
Yeah, that I don't have a very expensive camera. We're waiting for a new one that's backordered, a brand new Olympus OMD, really fancy schmancy one. But for the last 10 years, I've just had a little point and shoot, and it's easy because you just carry it in your purse and just trying to post it on my Facebook page. I have a page specifically for my artwork, and I have fans from kind of all over the world, and most of them are just really interested in Alaska and seeing images from Alaska. And I thought, well, I'll just try to make that a goal every day, go out somewhere different, different kinds of weather, get different pictures of different mountains or the channel or boat harbors. And, you know, it gets hard after a while to try and get something new, you know, every day.
Yeah.
And but I sort of persevered, and I think I mostly did it up until just, you know, the last month or so, when I've really been working to finish this show. So I have them all posted on this page, and when I got ready, so my hard drive crashed.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, before,
always,
right,
yeah.
When I was getting ready to start the show, and I worked from photographs, so all the compositions I had already done, which represented hundreds of hours of work, gone overnight. So I just went back to this Facebook page, and I started going through all these images that I'd taken over the last year and looking at ones, you know, which place had the most meaning to me, which seemed to get, like, the best feedback from the audience, you know, sort of a little, you know, editorial process there. And then I just picked my favorites and kind of started from there. So it was a little bit different for me to start really based on the photos. And they're all places that sort of have personal meaning to me. The glacier, Mount Hawthorne, which is kind of right across the channel from my living room. And I've taken hundreds of photographs, like in the fall and the winter and the summer, you know. So that's kind of was my starting point. And
so you did the oils based on the photographs.
Yes.
How does a photograph translate into an oil painting? Is that kind of analogous to the problem of putting a movie together out of a book?
Well, it's, you know, and I mentioned this in my press release, it's kind of a struggle when you're really familiar with a place and you're trying to do a painting that's very compositionally balanced. And
what does that mean?
Just that it all kind of has equal weight. The color on one side is you know, equal,
okay,
on this, you know, that it just feels,
yeah,
right. There's just a,
yeah,
sense,
so,
of when,
yeah,
something has
still
a good composition.
Feels right when you look at it.
Yeah, and
yeah,
a lot of things in nature, the compositions are strong. It just depends on how you frame your shot if you're working from photography. But then sometimes it's like I feel, oh, this would be a stronger composition if there was another tree here or something,
yeah,
you know, like,
yeah,
and, you know, the purists would say, oh, you can't do that. That's wrong. And anyway, most purists don't work from photographs to begin with. So there's already that kind of element. But I just feel like ultimately it's more about the painting than about the photograph and trying to just capture what a place feels like. It might not be 100% representational, but I feel like we already have photographs to be 100% representational. So a photo can be more, a painting can be more evocative, you know, more about how a place makes you feel and the lighting and the sense of it than, oh, there are only 10 trees there, not 11, or, you know.
Let me ask you a question that I've always wanted to ask an artist. If I come to your show, how do you want me to look at your presentation? How do you want me to see it?
Well,
What would you hope I would do when I look at what you have on the wall for us to view?
I don't really have any preconceived ideas of how people should interact with the paintings. I see some people with their eyes right up close. They want to see all the little brush strokes. And, you know, if you stand back a little further, you get a, you know, a completely different sense of a piece than when you're up very close. You know, I like to stand back about maybe 12 feet from a piece. But if you look at it from a couple different, you know, depths or closenesses, and that you spend a little time looking at it. Some people, they just do the quick walkthrough. You know, they kind of glance. You miss a lot of little details. I have this large painting of the glacier, and there's two tiny little figures that were done to scale because it's really these little figures that let you realize how massive the glacier really is. And if you just glanced past that, you wouldn't even notice these two little figures. And that changes, I think, the whole feeling of that piece, is to really experience the grandeur of the Mendenhall Glacier. So, you know, just giving it a little time. And I also am going to have a few little comments about the area and when I took the photo, you know, kind of like what was happening on that particular day, because I think that can kind of give a little more story. And some of them I've added figures to, doing things like, you know, reading in the forest or one's playing the guitar. I mean, it's just kind of solo activities. I spend a lot of time alone in the woods, and those are more just fantasy type, you know.
Yeah. Okay, so the show is, the opening reception is 4:30 to 7 on May 4th.
Yes.
And then how long will we have after that, to after the reception, when we come back to spend a little time? How long will your show be up?
Well, and that's a good point. I think openings are pretty crowded, and sometimes you do want to get in and out pretty quickly, but it will be up through the month of May, and I think it comes down on the 27th.
So we have a lot of time to come
to
down
back,
and stand 12 feet away from the painting and kind of get a sense of how it is, and then move from side to side.
If you so choose. You know, I sometimes do the quick walkthrough as well. You know, I think there's something to be said for that.
I have to tell you a little story. Three years ago, you did a show where you had reproduced some of the photographs on refrigerator magnets.
Right.
And I scarfed one of those off. It's still on my refrigerator.
Cool.
When I walk past it, I still see that same image of that lovely lady that you painted in the grass, lying in the grass. And I see that. I do exactly what you're talking about. I spent a lot of time on that picture. So
yeah,
your pictures are worth spending some time with.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I met someone at the roller derby who said, I have your I have a print of your of the sandy beach of the pump house, and she said, and every time I see it, it just makes me feel, you know, so good and relaxed and happy, and like that's probably one of the best things an artist can ever hear.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you're having the show. I look forward to getting a chance to go over and spend a little time with some of Elisa's wonderful art.
Thanks, Pat.
Thank you.
Here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 1st of May, 2012. It was on this date in 1840 the first official adhesive postage stamp was issued in Great Britain. Up until then, the recipient of a letter paid for the postage. But many people refused, and the calculation of postage had to be figured out. Number of sheets of paper, the distance between sender and recipient, and with the adhesive postage stamp, the sender paid, and there was one price. Queen Victoria's picture was on the stamp, and because Britain was the first to use postage stamps, they've never put the name of the country on them, just a picture of the reigning monarch. It's the birthday of Joseph Addison, Wiltshire, England, 1672, along with his friend Richard Steele. Addison was an essayist for the newspaper The Tatler, and then The Spectator, essays that aimed to, he said, enliven morality with wit and to temper wit with morality. 1707, on this date, the Acts of Union joined the kingdoms of England and Scotland into the kingdom of Great Britain. They'd had a single monarch for 100 years since Queen Elizabeth I died childless. James VI of Scotland became James I of England. The Acts of Union combined their two parliaments into one. It's the birthday of Bobby Ann Mason, born Mayfield, Kentucky, 1940, raised on a dairy farm. Wrote her Ph.D. dissertation on Nabokov, and then set out to write something completely different. She said, since Huckleberry Finn, or thereabouts, it seemed that all American literature was about the alienated hero. I was sick of reading about the alienated hero. I'm more interested in people in the mainstream. So she wrote about rural and small-town people in Kentucky. Her first collection was Shiloh and Other Stories. Her first novel was In Country. Her most recent, The Girl in the Blue Beret, published last summer. It's the birthday of Terry Southern, born Alvarado, Texas, 1924, who wrote the screenplay Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. And it was on this date, 1931, the Empire State Building opened to the public. Here's a poem for today by Mark Strand, entitled Black Sea. One clear night, while the others slept, I climbed the stairs to the roof of the house, and under a sky strewn with stars, I gazed at the sea, at the spread of it, the rolling crests of it, raked by the wind, becoming like bits of lace tossed in the air. I stood in the long whispering night, waiting for something, a sign, the approach of a distant light, and I imagined you coming closer, the dark waves of your hair mingling with the sea, and the dark became desire, and desire the arriving light, the nearness, the momentary warmth of you, as I stood on that lonely height, watching the slow swells of the sea break on the shore and turn briefly into glass and disappear. Why did I believe you would come out of nowhere? Why, with all that the world offers, would you come only because I was here? A poem by Mark Strand, Black Sea, from his collection Man and Camel, published by Knopf and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Constant Contact, now offering social campaigns, a new tool designed to help small businesses turn fans into customers. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. And by Reputation.com, offering patented protection for the online reputations of professionals and businesses, now including reputation assessments. Learn more at Reputation.com. Written by Holly Vanderhaar, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Four, you're in tune with KTOO News. My next guest is Jessica Paris, and Jessica is here to tell us about a program called Bead for Life. Who are we beading, and what are we beading?
Yeah, hi. Well, today at KTOO, there's going to be a Bead for Life party from 5 to 6 o'clock down in the KTOO boardroom. And Bead for Life is a unique organization that brings handmade beads from Uganda to markets in the United States. It's a nonprofit organization. It was founded in 2004. And their goal is to eradicate poverty, extreme poverty, in Uganda. And so they hope that in bringing the products here, not only do they raise a good working wage for the women who are making the products, but then the profits are also used to do other good works within the country, like providing women with entrepreneurial training and providing microloans, a little bit in education, that sort of thing.
This is being sponsored locally by a Girl Scout troop. Yeah. How does that connection get made?
Well, it is being sponsored by Brownie Troop 4028. And Bead for Life really has this whole education component to it. And so they have a whole curriculum that that they've developed for children. And so our troop use this as an opportunity both to learn about poverty in other parts of the world and also then to try to address it in some way.
If people come to the studio between 5 and 6, what can they expect to see and do?
They will see these beautiful, unique beads that have been made into bracelets and necklaces and earrings. There will also be some African finger foods that the troupe has made and a little bit of information about the organization. And even some information about how to host a bead party if you decided that that was something you wanted to do. They kind of operate on the, I guess, on the Tupperware model of people, or maybe Pampered Chef. You know, someone can host a party for free in their home, invite their friends to come over and buy beads, and then the money goes back to the organization and on to the women and organizations in Uganda.
And just before we took the mic, you told me that the way this program has gotten organized, they only take out about 7 or 8% for administrative costs, and that means that 93% of the dollars that are collected here go straight back into Uganda.
I think another 2% goes to media, but but their website is fantastic. There's a lot of information there. Just Bead for Life. Mm-hmm. You can see how they're spending their money, what their what their mission is, how they developed. It's a very heartwarming site, and I mean they've really gained great national attention. Oprah's magazine, I think USA Today, that sort of thing. And something that's sweet for us is that one of the co-founders actually came to Juneau as a either an AmeriCorps or a VISTA volunteer back in the mid-90s. She was out at the Saga Lodge working there with Juneau's youth. And after that, went on to get her master's in, I think, international development, and then went on to help co-found this community. So it's just very sweet for us.
So you're carrying on a long Juneau tradition.
And Juneau connections. Okay. Now, I think, kind of based out of Colorado, but...
Okay, so once more, it's Bead for Life. It's at 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock today. Finger foods from Africa, lovely beaded bracelets. You're wearing one, which is quite striking. And these will be on display and for sale from 5 to 6 in the boardroom, right, in the main entrance to the KTLO building.
That's right. And a bracelet, I mean, I think a bracelet's $5. Necklaces go up to about $25. It's very affordable. There's also a few shea butter products. And even if you just want to see them and think about hosting your own party, that would be great. Or if you go online, you can order them online, too, if you can't come in today.
Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you.
Oh, won't you save all your pumpkin pie? Oh, won't you save all your pumpkin pie? Oh, won't you save all your pumpkin pie just for me, girl? Please don't give none away. Let it get sweeter by the day. But won't you save it, baby? Please save it. Come on and save it all for me. Oh, won't you save all your cherry jam? Oh, won't you save all your cherry jam? Oh, won't you save all your cherry jam just for me, girl? Please don't give none away. Let it get sweeter by the day. Oh, won't you save it, baby? Please save it. Come on and save it all for me.
Lost dog. Pete, a small gray terrier, is lost trying to find his way home. He was last seen at 4th and Gold at about noon. He has a white stripe on his chest, a collar with peace signs on it, and a red tag from GHS. So if you happen to see Pete, call Brady Wilson. He's at 404-531-8745. I think that's a cell phone, so you should be able to get him up. So we're looking for Pete. Dark gray terrier, got a white stripe on the chest, collar with peace signs on it, red tag from GHS, call Brady Wilson, 404-531-8745 if you see Pete. My next guests are many. I have a studio full of people here. It's kind of cool. These are folks who are visiting us at Floyd Dryden. Liz Gifford is here with Jeanette Sleppy, and they are the... host teachers, I guess, for part of the Rose Urban Rural Exchange Program. Would somebody like to briefly tell us what it is that Rose Urban set up here?
Rose Urban Rural Exchange is part of the Alaska Humanities Forum, and they have set up a program where urban communities and rural communities in Alaska are paired up, and so that each community can have students and a teacher serve as cultural ambassadors, spend time in each other's communities, learn about each other's cultures, and build bridges.
And the people who are arrayed here in front of me, quickly, tell me your name.
Oh, my name is Kian.
Okay, and?
My name is Vasila Fijet.
Okay.
My name is Kristen Hendrickson.
My name is Christine Taylor.
My name's Joyce Turner.
Good, Joyce.
I'm Justin Sleppy.
Okay. And now, with the exception, I think, of Justin, sounds like you're a ringer, right? Are you part of the exchange as well?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and all of you have either are either here visiting from someplace or you've been out on exchange, is that right?
That is correct.
Yep. Yep. Okay, yep. So who's from where?
Well, I'm from Juneau here, okay. And I actually go to Forge Island Middle School.
Okay, and this young lady?
I'm from Guigluk.
Okay, you're in from out of town, and?
And I'm from Guigluk as well.
Okay.
I'm from McGrath.
Okay.
I'm from McGrath.
Okay.
And I'm from Juneau.
Okay, so the idea then is that you go to another place and basically immerse yourself in the culture for how long? How long are you here with us?
We were staying up in Queefluck for one full week from Sunday through Sunday, and we did everything that our Queefluck hosts, with our Queefluck hosts, we went to class with them, we ate dinners with them, and then we also were working in different research projects, our areas of exploration. So we learned about the water and sewer system of Queefluck. We also learned about ice fishing, or manuking, and we were also curious about Yupik language and how they learn it and how often they learn it.
My two Queefluck people, how'd they take it? How were they?
Everybody was just great participants. There wasn't anything that we did that anyone said, Nobody freaked. We're not going to try that. And they were willing to try some things that we just kind of threw at them sort of last minute. And they were just our first group that we've ever hosted in Queefluck since, and it was great.
Good. It's 7 days. So what kind of stuff did you do with them besides the ice fishing and that sort of thing? Did they stay in your homes?
They were at the school.
At the school. Okay. Did you fix them some meals?
Yes.
How did?
One night we did do a native potluck at our house, the teacher's house, and they got to try everything from dried fish to dried ptarmigan with seal oil, beaver. They ate Eskimo donuts with fry bread. And a gooduck, they helped make it.
Ah. So, now, okay, and McGrath folks, did you host an exchange as well?
We did. We hosted during the Iditarod sled dog race.
Ah, okay.
So they came at that time and were able to help at the checkpoint. They helped to make some desserts for the mushers because the community feeds the mushers. Then they did some of their own areas of exploration. So,
and then Juneau people. You're hosting some of the out folks, right? Just right now? So what are you doing with them? Where have you been taking them?
We're going to be doing many events with them. We're going to take them to the glacier, and we're also going to bring them to the new swimming pool.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And are you cooking a meal?
Yep, we're going to be doing a potluck today.
Okay, what's a Juneau food that you're going to serve? I'm curious.
Fish.
Fish. Well, one would think so.
We have a lot of smoked salmon that was donated.
Oh, okay.
Some Dungeness crab, some halibut.
Ah.
And then we have a family originally from the Philippines, so they're going to bring some lumpia, and Kiang's family's from Korea, so they made some sushi and potstickers, is it?
Dumplings.
Yeah, and dumplings. So lots of good food for tonight.
Hey, Ned, can I get invited?
Plenty of food coming.
Yeah, sounds right. Okay, and then how long are you here? The out of town folks, are you just starting 7 days, or are you in the middle of
it? They just arrived last night.
Okay,
and they will leave on Sunday. So
And then you're going to be in the classroom with the Floyd Dryden students as well during the time you're here, right?
Today,
yeah. Yep. We were today in the first class, and then we went. We tried to go to the NOAA, and we got lost a few times.
Yeah.
We stopped at three different buildings.
Out the road to the NOAA fisheries facility. Yeah. Okay, well, I'm glad we could arrange for typical Juneau weather. We wouldn't want to give you the idea that it's always sunny and warm down here, and we got it just right. We're looking at 2 or 3 days of rain, but Thursday and Friday you should have some sunshine, so a chance to get outside a little bit. Are you going up to Eagle Crest with them?
We're not going to go up to Eagle Crest, but I'm definitely exploring the glacier, and hopefully they get a chance to touch the Menin Hall.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Well, Juneau is a wonderful place to explore, and it sounds like you had great exploration in Queefluck and also in McGrath, so a chance to really kind of learn across. This is really a wonderful program. How long has it been in existence?
I think at least 10 years, if not longer. I know Floyd Dryden has been participating for about that amount of time. This is my third exchange before I've been to Deering and to Allakaket. So it's been given me an amazing opportunity to travel the state and learn about different communities and cultures within Alaska, and then come back and teach that to my own students. So it's like they get an experience of the trip themselves.
I almost wish I could talk to the people from out of town at the end of the experience and find out how it was for you, how you learned about the community and what you learned. That'd be wonderful. We're just almost totally out of time. I guess one quick question: how do students get selected into the exchanges? What does someone have to do to be chosen?
For the Juno students, we asked them to write kind of an essay explaining why they would be a good, strong candidate as a cultural ambassador. What would they bring to the program, and how would they make connections with the communities that they visit? Because it was hard, because in each of our, Jeanette and my classes, we have 50 students to choose from.
Yeah.
And so that was a big part of the process.
So you did it with an essay?
With an essay. Kind of.
So everyone who wants to engage in this probably needs to start practicing essay writing right now.
But also, not just a strong writer, but also a general overall positive attitude and willingness to try new things. That's an important thing. And willingness to try something that might make them uncomfortable at first, but overall that they know they would learn from it.
What a wonderful program. Okay. Thanks for coming down.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Juno Afternoon on KTOO. KTOO is translated throughout the valley and areas on a set of translators. We are broadcast on 103.1. On K276 AF in the Valley in Auk Bay. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, we're on K269 AO, that's at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM at 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Straits, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS at 89.9.